Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Caroline Crampton, standing in for your regular host, Helen Lewis. On this week's edition, George Eaton and Anoush Shakalian tell us about Labour and the problem of getting young people to vote. Ian Steadman brings us news from the internet, where the founder of 4chan has stepped down. And Tom Gatty and I discuss Wolf Hall, the new TV adaptation of Hilary Mantel's novel. I'm here with Anoush Shakalian and George Eaton, and we're going to start with Anoush. You went on a road trip with Liam Byrne in Essex this week, I understand. Tell us what happened and why.
Well, basically, last week, Ed Miliband made this big speech talking about the plight of young people and how, how Labour is concerned about the fact that 2 million young voters have no intention of voting at the general election. It's something that the Labour Party want to aim for, getting these young people back into the democratic process. And so Liam Byrne is going on this, Liam Byrne, who is Shadow Universities Minister, is going on this road trip this week around Essex and Estuary England, where UKIP are taking hold, to speak to young people and to get their ideas of what they'd like to see Labour do. Because he's making a young people's manifesto, which they're going to publish by the end of February. So I went along with him, and he was asking young people about their concerns about tuition fees, about apprenticeships, and about work experience. So it looks like he's gathering quite a lot of ideas to back up Labour's big higher education policy announcement that they're set to make at any time now. Ed Miliband said, watch this space. And so there's a lot of speculation about what that's going to be. I've heard different things. One of the things that has come out before is that Labour will slash the fees down to 6,000. Or Liam Byrne is very keen on a graduate tax, but it looks like that's more of a long-term aim rather than something they'll announce before May.
George, what have you heard on that?
Well, pretty much that Ed Miliband's made it clear for a long time that he wants, in his words, a radical offer on tuition fees, and actually said during his leadership campaign that he wanted a graduate tax. But I don't think it's something that Labour envisaged being able to promise to introduce in one term. I think simply because it would be so disruptive in terms of what it would mean for universities' immediate funding streams.
But we did see back in 2010, 2011, this is an issue that mobilises vast numbers of young people. Mm. So in that sense, Liam Byrne is working in the right area. And I saw some of your pictures. You've written a very good long article about this. You can get on newstatesman.com. I saw some of the pictures you took, particularly that one of Liam Byrne at the boxing club. What was the sort of atmosphere on the trip like? Because, I don't know, from the pictures, it seemed a little bit thick of it to me, a little bit awkward ministerial visit.
There was quite a thick of it moment when we went to this boxing club in Dagenham with John Cruddas, who is the local MP there, where they posed wearing these boxing gloves. But the idea, the good intentions are there. Something that's interesting about the boxing club is that it unites a community that was actually, under a lot of pressure from the BNP not so long ago. And so that's quite an interesting parallel to draw with these communities, particularly more along the East Coast, where UKIP are taking hold and actually our young voters are becoming quite interested in them. In Thurrock, I think it's something like 35% of young people have said that if they vote, they're going to vote for UKIP there. So that it is an interesting parallel. So there was a point to the visit. But yes, I know what you mean. Those pictures are sometimes ill-advised.
So looking beyond just Labour, George, you've written today about this. We've all heard it, this perception that, Labour and Tories, they're all just the same. What's the point? Why should I vote for either or at all? You've written in your column in the magazine that actually they're not the same, and this perception is very harmful. Tell us about that.
Yes, so as you say, the charge, You Were the Same, is one that's heard more often now than for many elections. And the irony of that, as I say in the piece, is that the ideological distance between the parties is greater than at any time since the 1992 election, and possibly earlier still. I mean, there are significant differences between them on tax, on the market, on the EU, and yet this charge, You All the Same, is still thrown in their faces. And the reason for that, I think, is because it's not, in most cases, about policy, it's about culture. That when people say You're All the Same, they don't mean Labour and the Tories will have identical manifestos, but the way they speak, the way they look, the way they act, the way they do politics, they are part of a shared Westminster culture. What I say is the political equivalent of the Eton Wall game or something. Mm.
I see. So it's more about the fact that we've talked about this for the last 4-5 years now, that Nick Clegg and David Cameron, although they belong to different parties, are from a similar social class, a similar background, all this kind of stuff. That's what people mean when they're saying
exactly that. And it's an issue of perception. So I quote a focus group finding from a report Policy Exchange did, which found that voters in the group thought Ed Miliband went to Eton. You know, of course, he went to a comprehensive school, but it's the assumption that he's the leader of a political party. He must have been to public school.
Mm. And Anoush, how do you see a way out of that for the parties? Is there a way they can communicate beyond that, or is this it now till the election?
It's quite difficult for them, because even if they do try and do politics differently, which is something Ed Miliband has spoken about quite a lot this Parliament, but I don't think has quite managed to achieve, they have these other parties that people are comparing them to now. So UKIP, who very much position themselves as outside the Westminster elite, and the Green Party, that, you know, makes itself look like quite a grassroots movement, which in many ways it is. And then you have the SNP in Scotland as well. So I think even if the parties do try and start doing politics differently, it's going to be quite a futile mission, because people who want to vote for something different have that offer.
And that's been the big story this week, hasn't it? The Greens surge in the polls, the fact that they've polled 10 more in some cases. This is something we've been sort of talking about and looking at for a while. Is this just the polls catching up? Is this a flash in the pan? What do we think, George?
Well, I think it's clear they've had a boost from David Cameron demanding that they be included in the debates, and the sense that they're railing against the establishment because they've been shut out. And now it's joined UKIP and Scotland as one of the big what-ifs of the general election. That's how the Greens perform will potentially have a very significant impact on in a close election. And that's less because of the seats they'll win. I expect that Caroline Lucas will hold on in Brighton now. There are only two others which people think they could conceivably win, which are Bristol West and Norwich South. But the key will be what they do to the Labour vote in Labour Tory marginals and the Lib Dem vote in Labour in Lib Dem Tory marginals. Because if they split the left in both cases, then it becomes much easier for the Tories to say, hang on, as the single largest party. And this is why one of the messages that Labour will push very strongly will be, you know, don't risk waiting for the Greens, because you'll end up with another 5 years of David Cameron in Downing Street, which is perfectly true. And you can make the usual arguments of tactical voting. But I think the key is to make a positive offer to voters, to inspire them to vote for Labour, rather than just the sense, well, we've got to vote for them to stop the Tories getting in, because actually the old tribal loyalties are far weaker than they used to be, and people are looking at new options. People, especially the young, I mean, the Greens are in joint second place with the Tories among young people, and making a sort of cynical, self-interested appeal to them to vote for you isn't enough.
And this comes back to where we started with young people and getting them to vote. I know, Anoush, you have written a profile of the constituency that Natalie Bennett, the Green Party leader, is standing in, Holborn and St Pancras, which I don't think she has much chance of winning, right? But is distinguished by having a very large student and therefore young population. Mm. What did you find there?
Well, it does work in the Greens' favour that there's lots of students there, but the problem with students is registration. So this is the big thing that parties like the Greens and Labour are very concerned about, because students could substantially help their chances. So what they're doing is they're going round universities and schools and making sure that young people at least register to vote. And it's National Registration Day, Voter Registration Day, at the beginning of February. So I think we'll see a lot more activity around then to get these young people on the register.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. Ian Steadman is now going to tell us about big news in the world of the internet, which is that one of the founders of 4chan...
The only founder,
has left the website.
Yes, 4chan is a website which when it's in the news, it's in the news for very bad reasons, it tends to be. But it's also a website which has had possibly an immeasurable effect on how internet culture has formed over the last decade. 4chan is a website that... It's a message board is what it is. It was the guy who founded it, this guy called Chris Poole. He's currently only 25 or 26, so he's still got a lot of way ahead of him now that he's stepping down from it. But he founded it when he was 15. He was just living in his parents' house in Brooklyn in New York, and he pretty much just he actually straight up ripped off a website called 2chan. There was a popular website in Japan called 2chan where people would come together and talk about anime and manga, and he was really into anime as well. So he got the source code for the 2chan website, ran the bits that were still in Japanese through Google Translate, and then just put it up on his own server, and that was 4chan. And the thing that makes 4chan strange is that everyone kind of posts anonymously.
Yeah.
It's like a forum, so there are several sub forums within it. That generally it started out as an anime discussion site, and then there was random and there was other stuff. But 4chan quickly gave rise to what's known as Chan culture, and in turn things like Anonymous and Gamergate. 4chan is the site of the birth of many of the internet's memes, like Rickrolling started there. Half the sort of stupid acronyms and things that you'll see people use, like LOL and ROFL, probably got popularized there more than anywhere else. If you've seen a meme, then it probably started on 4chan. 4chan might actually be responsible for the word meme becoming the word that we use to describe memes. Like, it's the way that internet culture has formed, as dumb and as ridiculous as it is in large part a reflection of what people are like on 4chan.
And some pretty horrible stuff has begun on there as well. Yeah.
4chan is something that defines Chan culture as an absolutist belief in free speech, which comes up against the law and morality quite often when people share, like when there was a huge hack of celebrity.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Personal images late last year, 4chan was one of the main sites where people were disseminating those images. Images of child abuse have been frequently posted on 4chan throughout its whole existence. There are people issue death threats at each other all the time. The practice of swatting might have originated there as well.
Swatting, we should explain.
Yes,
is...
SWAT teams in America being, you know, armed police who go and respond to like hostage situations. So what you do is if you have an argument with someone that you dislike on the internet, you find out where they live. And then you call the police and say that someone's holding someone hostage with a gun there. And the SWAT team will, in standard practice, they'll storm the building throwing in, like, flashbangs and smoke grenades and stuff. And they might even shoot someone. People have been killed by this. Mm. And it's become a favoured tactic. And it also kind of makes sense as well because on 4chan, as I said, everyone posts anonymously. Like, revealing someone's real identity on 4chan is like the greatest sin.
Yeah, the ultimate escalation,
yeah.
Isn't it?
So, yeah, so like the ultimate act of retaliation is to reveal their identity to the police and then let them take care of it. And that in turn also has its own weird sort of code of ethics on 4chan where, as I say, posting sort of images of child abuse can be justified as an act of free speech, but revealing the identity of someone who's posting those images is the gravest sin against ethics. It's a strange, strange place, and it can terrify a lot of people who aren't used to it. As you can always see when stuff like the Anonymous movement goes after someone that doesn't know what's happened to them, or Gamergate, which is the most sort of recent expression of that.
So we've established it's been a massive and pervasive influence over the internet. The fact that this guy's, its founder is now...
Yeah.
Stepping back, what does that mean?
Well, it's interesting. He wrote this blog post yesterday talking about it, and he said that, I mean, Fortran, it's 11 and a half years old. All that time, it's basically just been this one guy, making sure that the servers are running, making sure that, I think there's a guy, there's one coder that he asked occasionally to help him out, but it's pretty much just him. But over the last 2 years, he's started asking moderators and other volunteers, because the site is like basically volunteers apart from him, to step up, people that, like, it sounds like there's a team that's in place to keep it going. So 4chan's probably going to stay exactly the same. What he hasn't said what he's going to do next. He says that he might return one day as an anon, as an anonymous poster, which is everyone else. But we wouldn't know because it's anonymous. And also, as I said, he's still only like 24 or 26, so he has the whole, like, everything ahead of him. He's still the age that most people are when they're only just starting their first tech startup. So, yeah.
So has he tried to make any money out of this website?
To the extent that you can run the website off it and stuff, and he's managed to make some money off it. I mean, it's not the most lucrative website in the world relative to its influence and infamy. I mean, it is an extremely well-read website. It's usually in the top 1,000 websites worldwide. At times, it's been in the top like 100 or top 50, depending on whatever it's doing that day. Be it, I don't know, like Reddit, which is also has inherited some of the same Chan culture things. There are good bits of 4chan as well, which can kind of throw you. Like, they might hear about a World War II veteran who is dying, who's died, and no one's going to his funeral. And so they'll send, like, loads of flowers to it, or, like, those people will turn up, and you're like, oh, maybe they're all right. And then the next week, they'll be doing what they did when Mountain Dew wanted people to vote on a new flavour, and the name of a new flavour of Mountain Dew, and they got Hitler Did Nothing Wrong to the top of the poll. So there are, you know, it's kind of a... it's a hard thing to rein in. And the team that's going to take over, if they want to keep it the same, that's fine. But if they want to do anything else with it, they're going to have a challenge on their hands, because the things that make people want to advertise on a site like that, they don't want to be associated with a lot of things 4chan does. So that's a problem.
They want popularity and they want traffic, but they don't want...
Yeah, you don't want to be associated with 4chan, really. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Ian. The New Statesman's culture editor Tom Gatty is now going to tell us a bit about the new BBC adaptation of Wolf Hall, hotly anticipated and, I think I'm right in saying, widely appreciated. What did you make of it, Tom?
I was actually slightly less effusive in my feelings towards the TV adaptation of Wolf Hall than most of the critics that I've read so far. I think it's one of those things where it's tempting to slightly reserve judgment until you're sort of two or three episodes in. It was very, very atmospheric, very dark, which is nice to see in a historical drama. Mm. It doesn't have any of that sort of glossy Tudors style lighting. When they're out on the Thames at night, it's really, really dark, which it presumably would have been.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the historical period of it felt very, very accurate, very atmospheric. Rylance is obviously a fantastic performer. All the performances were good. But my one problem with it is that it felt almost like it played its cards a bit too early in terms of painting Thomas Cromwell as this complex character. It seemed to be working very hard to make him quite sympathetic. So you get a lot of his relationship with his wife and children. Spoiler alert, his wife and children die.
It's all a spoiler. It all happened hundreds of years ago.
Which is very, very moving in the books and in the stage adaptation, but is pushed to the background. So it happens sort of off stage. Mm. The TV adaptation made quite a big deal of showing that, I think, because they're anxious to make you really care about Cromwell and see his human side. And I'm just a little bit I'm a little bit anxious about how that is going to play out. I felt that in the stage adaptation, Cromwell's humanity really came out, and your sympathy for him did develop, but it sort of happened in the background without you really noticing it.
I share your concern there, actually, and obviously we've only had the first of six episodes to go out every week, so we'll see how it goes. But I felt, especially the way the books, Wolf Hall and Bring Out the Bodies, the way they work, is it's all about Cromwell's sort of interiority, his interior thoughts. So you see everything, you feel everything that he thinks, and you find yourself in sympathy with him, kind of in spite of some of his impulses. And I guess that wasn't really there so much, because they've, as you say, plunged straight into trying to make him feel like he's your friend, he's your guide through this world.
Yes, and it's interesting for those of us who've read the books and seen the plays and are now watching the TV adaptations. I'm trying to think of another example where all those three things have happened in such a relatively short period of time.
I can't think of one myself.
Yeah. It really, it requires a real recalibration with each format, because screen is a more, I absolutely love the stage adaptations, but screen is a quieter and should be a more introspective medium, as in that it allows to show the interiority of the characters more than the stage, where the dialogue has to keep rolling, basically. So it was interesting to see that. I think having said all that, the performances were really striking, and striking just to see a whole cast of different actors take on these roles that you've become very attached to. I mean, I spent the first half hour really just trying to get rid of Ben Miles, who played Cromwell so brilliantly in the stage adaptation, and adjust to Rylance.
Yes, I'm very interested to see what Anton Lesser does as well. He's a favourite actor of mine, so I was excited to see him in it. And it's, I don't know, it is interesting when you've, as you say, when you've had now two adaptations of a novel within such a short space of time. But I suppose we shouldn't really be surprised that that's the case. Hilary Mantel is a sensation. These books were a sensation. They won unprecedented numbers of prizes. Do you think there's something about her writing that lends itself to adaptation that's encouraging people to go for this?
I wouldn't have said so when I first read the book, I have to say. I wouldn't have said this is prime, you know, this is prime for a high-profile BBC series and a West End stage hit. Because the first book particularly is, as a lot of readers and critics noticed at the time, is it's not immediately an easy read. It has this very sort of dense interior style. There's lots of sort of pronouns going on, and mixed pronouns. It doesn't immediately scream kind of on screen drama, but now that this process has unravelled, you can see that, in a way, all the material is there for cracking. I think it's less Mantel's style and more that it comes with a great sort of bunch of historical baggage, which is easy to sell to a film company or to a TV company, because you've got, you know, if you haven't read the books, you still know that you've got a great story of Henry VIII and his wives. And it's been interesting to me to see how the press around, the pre-publicity press around Wolf Hall, has very much focused on Henry VIII, even though he's not the main character.
He's barely in the first episode, yeah. And we'll see what happens later. But yeah, he's barely there.
There's just been lots of glossy pictures of Damien Lewis sort of posing in his codpiece. it was pleasing to see that the adaptation actually stuck to its guns and said, yes, this is a story about Cromwell. That will change over the course of it, but they haven't fallen so in love with Damien Lewis that they've sidelined the character of Cromwell, which would be very upsetting indeed.
That would be upsetting, yes. Well, thanks very much, Tom. We'll see how it develops. Thanks for listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Caroline Crampton. Our producer today was Anna Leskovich. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and you can find more details and all our back episodes on newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.